I would ask you to turn to Ephesians chapter 5, but there's really not any point in it since I'm preaching the white space between verses 21 and 22. There's really nothing to read there, except that you remember I'm spending a couple of Sundays here as a parenthetical note at this point, because I'm convinced that it is essential that we understand Paul's world view regarding marriage in order to understand what he says in Ephesians 5, starting in verse 22. So the white space in between is to stop and to say, what is it that Paul thinks marriage is first? And then as we understand what it is, then we can come into this text and say, okay, now I see why Paul can make these kinds of statements. Now, we started last Sunday with a definition of marriage. We started off to saying this is what marriage is. And you remember there are a number of things that I said, but I want to sift it down into three specific things. Number one, for Paul and for Scripture, marriage is a creation ordinance. It stands at the very heart of human civilization. It's at the very heart of human dominion over this world. It's at the very heart of what it means for God to create a people and place them in this world. Remember, the very first thing that God said is, let us make man in our image, male and female. He created them. And then he turns immediately and says, now, this is your world. Take dominion over it. So marriage is a creation ordinance. Marriage serves as the foundation of human life. It serves as the foundation of civilization, culture, and everything that goes along with what it means to be human. Secondly, creation is a creative act. Not only is it a mandate in this world in terms of what God himself has established, but it's also the very pinnacle of God's creative activity. God creates the man or forms the man from the dust of the ground and says it is not good for the man to be alone. And so he puts the man into a sleep. He takes out one of his ribs. He forms it into the shape of a woman and he brings the woman to the man and joins them back together again as a one flesh union. It's a creative act at the very pinnacle of God's creative activity because it is a visible picture of God's nature itself. The unity of God in the Godhead, the Father, Son, and Spirit, is pictured in this relationship between husband and wife. God creates something new as a man and a woman are brought together in holy matrimony. But then, thirdly, it is also a covenant relationship. Marriage stands at the very core of the redemptive relationship that human beings have with God. It serves as a bond between a man and a woman, which parallels God's relationship with his own chosen people. There is a bride for Christ, a people that belong to him, that are being brought to him in a one flesh union. There's a covenant relationship being established between a husband and a wife, which is paralleling the covenant relationship that God has with his chosen people. It stands at the very heart of creation itself. It in itself is a creative act, the pinnacle creative act of God in regards to humanity. And then finally, it mirrors the covenant relationship that God has with his chosen people. Marriage is not fundamentally about us. It's about God. It's about his purposes. It's about his creativity. It's about his mandate into this world and what he's doing. Any definition, as I said last week, any definition that minimizes the idea of God's central purposes in creating this world and establishing a people for his own and bringing those people to himself, any definition that's different than that is utterly wrong. In fact, it is a counterfeit to what it is that God has established in this relationship. But we're not finished with this definition. There's more to it than that. You would say, really? More than that? Yes. More than that. I want to continue this definition by talking about two other aspects of marriage that I think are essential, particularly in our day and age, as marriage is being continually redefined. by discussing both its value and its boundaries. Let's talk first about its value. What is the value of marriage? Now, within the very definition that I gave you a moment ago, you could express some value for it, and we'll certainly go there. But I want to just pause for a moment and back up for a second and remind you that I said that marriage is not fundamentally a Christian institution. It preexisted the church by thousands of years, and marriage has been a part of every culture on this planet. Whether that culture knew God or not, it has always existed. So the value of marriage must be more than just a Christian perspective. It comes out of the very creation mandate itself, in which the whole world is affected by this institution. Every culture has been affected by this institution. So that leads us to a fundamental question that we should probably be asking, especially as Americans. What is the benefit of marriage to society? Is there a benefit of marriage as it is uncovered and unpacked here to society as a whole? And the answer is twofold. Number one, marriage is the cornerstone of a vital economic and cultural continuation. Marriage is the cornerstone of a vital economic and cultural continuation, especially as that union produces the next generations in procreation. Be fruitful and multiply. And so as we multiply, we create a vital economic and cultural continuation. It's the engine of cultural growth. It's the engine of economic growth. If you don't believe me, look at what has taken place in Western culture over the last 100 years. Marriage itself has been diminished as an institution. The result of that is less children are being produced. The net result of that is the economies of those nations that have bought into this picture have declined without fail. Every one of them. There is a crisis. There is an economic crisis taking place in Europe that most people are not really familiar with. Some of you may be. But there is a massive economic problem going on in Europe, in that there are not enough people being born to replace those who are dying. And the net result of that is that the economic engines of those nations are collapsing. I would argue it's also occurring here. It's also occurring here. Today, we have reached a point, the tipping point, in which almost, not quite yet in America, but we're getting close, almost the tipping point, where we are not producing enough children to sustain our economy any longer. And when you add on top of that abortion on demand, the net result is a floundering economy. But secondly, marriage is also the cornerstone of stability amongst the citizens of a society. It is also demonstrative that nations who lose the value of marriage in the culture become unstable, in that they are easy prey for other systems of thought, or even economic systems or military systems even, that come against them. Again, it's been shown time after time. When the stability of the family is reduced, the necessary effect of that is that very institution itself, the very society itself, becomes subject to plunder. Now, I'm speaking of these things strictly in a non-religious sense. The two points I just made are entirely in a non-religious sense. The typical agnostic or atheist probably, if they were intelligent enough, would agree with what I just said. Society should promote a healthy and biblical view of marriage because it is the means to moral stability and economic growth. Now, again, when you have a society that's self-absorbed, the problem, of course, is they're not going to be thinking that way. And so our culture is not looking for that. In fact, quite the opposite. We have reached a point now where there are less people married in our society than there are single. We've reached a point where there are less people married in our society that are single in our society. And we scratch our heads and wonder why our economy struggles. But not only is there a general value to marriage, a secular value, but there is obviously a Christian one as well. And this is where I want to very carefully tread into Ephesians 5, 21 to 33, but I want to do so without doing any exegesis of the text. Because if I do exegesis of the text, I wipe out what I want to say next week. But I don't want to do that. Okay? So I want to talk about this just very, very 30,000 feet, if you will. You are probably undoubtedly familiar with what Paul says in 22 to 33 of Ephesians 5, right? Wives, be submissive to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Now, the first reaction to this text most often, and how it's most often prepared and presented in churches, is that this is standards that are established for how husbands and wives are to relate to one another, okay? That's how the sort of the knee-jerk reaction to this text is. This is how husbands and wives are supposed to relate. Wives, be submissive. Husbands, love your wives. And if you both do these things the way you're supposed to, everything will be hunky-dory. Problem is that that's not exactly what Paul's going after here. I know that's the knee-jerk reaction. And there's a sense in which that's true. Yes, Paul is talking about how we relate to one another, but there is a greater purpose to this text. And as we get through the exegesis, you'll see it. What Paul does here is he uses marriage as an example of Christ's relationship with his church. What matters more to Paul here is not really how husbands and wives relate to one another, although that's important. He's more concerned about how Christ relates to the church and what the church's relationship is to Christ. That's much more important to him here. And so he's seeing marriage through the lens of his worldview, and he's comparing the husband-wife relationship to the relationship of Christ with his church. He's making a comparison. Because you see, in the picture, we are all the wife. We're the bride. The command that's given in the first few verses applies to all of us, male or female. Yes, in the marriage relationship in your own personal house, it belongs to the woman in that relationship. I get it. But in the larger picture, where's Paul going? Paul's going to a discussion of the church because you remember, he's talking about how we as a church are to act, to be unified, to love one another, etc. And he's using the various relationships, the various different kinds of relationships that we have, our relationship with God, our relationship with one another, our relationships of husbands and wives, as examples of what it means to truly be a church led by his Spirit. A true church of God. So he's bringing us a picture of it. And by the way, in case you haven't figured it out, the picture that you see in Ephesians 5, 22 to 33 is based on an arranged marriage. It's built on an arranged marriage. Now, most of us find that concept frightening. Most of us find that concept beyond our imaginations because in the culture in which we live, the concept of an arranged marriage is beyond our comprehension. I mean, we marry for love, right? But in Paul's day, arranged marriages were common and ordinary. And when Paul brings this idea of marriage up, he's bringing up the idea of an arranged marriage because he's bringing up the idea of a father seeking a bride for his son. What is God doing? He's building, he's finding a wife. He's going out and looking for a wife. And in this case, uniquely to him, of course, he doesn't just go find a wife, he builds one. Does that not sound familiar with what he did in Genesis 2? When Adam went looking for a wife, couldn't find one. There was none to find. So what did God do? He built him one. He made one. He took a part of the man and he formed it into the bride and brought the woman to the man. And let me suggest to you, my friends, that's exactly what God is doing today as he goes out into the world and he takes out hearts of stone and he puts in hearts of flesh and he draws people to Christ and he is building from the side of Christ himself the bride, person by person through time. See it? Paul's emphasis here is not upon the relationship between husband and wife. That's subtext. The Christian value of marriage is that it is a picture. It is a picture of the self-sacrificial love of Jesus Christ, which creates an intimate one-flesh relationship between himself and the church, which is pictured in marriage. There's a one-flesh relationship between those who belong to Jesus, who are his bride. And the submission that we have as to our husband, in this case, metaphorically, is a submission of faith and obedience and love and allegiance and love for one another and love for the church and love for the world with the gospel. See it? In other words, the New Testament purpose of marriage is to picture the intimate relationship between Christ and his church. Thus, Christian marriage is much more than need fulfillment. It is a love relationship built on mutual self-sacrifice and radical other-centeredness. What you have as husbands and wives is to picture this beautiful work of God the Father to build a wife for his son. Marriage is a divine institution established for the welfare of society. Yes, all society benefits from marriage being solid and strong. Certainly for the betterment of society and the betterment of individuals. But it's also an example of the relationship of God that he has established between himself and his chosen people in Jesus Christ. What's the value of marriage? It's a picture. Ultimately a picture. A society, I should say, a church that flourishes is a church that understands that connection and understands it well. So in order to define marriage, we not only have to see its definition biblically, but we have to extend ourselves out and think about the value of it. What does it really mean to us as a church? But now I want to talk about the boundaries of marriage. And to do that, we have to talk about the reality of the curse. We have to talk about the curse. The curse, with a capital C, by the way, curse with a capital C, is the judgments pronounced by God upon all that he had created as a consequence of Adam's sin. Not Eve's sin. Adam's sin. The consequence of the fall. The fall belongs to Adam. He gets the blame for the fall. I know. Don't turn to your wife and point at her as though it's her fault. That woman that thou gavest me, right? No. It was his fault. And as I suggested last week, the problem is that Adam failed to take dominion over that which he should have taken dominion of, and that is all of creation, including that creature that was walking around trying to tempt his wife. And he failed to do that. Thus, he brought upon creation a curse, which came out, of course, in the actual sin of them eating the fruit of the tree. The term, of course, comes from Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. Cursed is the ground because of you. And in that passage, we see how this curse plays itself out. If you'll turn in your Bible to Genesis chapter 3 this morning. Genesis chapter 3, starting in verse 14. The Lord God said, now here comes the pronouncements that God is going to make upon all of those who were involved in this transgression. The Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all beasts of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. Now, I know that the common interpretation of what we teach children here is that God turned it into the serpent into a snake, but that's not really what's being said here. It's not really the point. The point is that this creature, Satan, in some sort of physical garb, is cursed by God to be humiliated, utterly humiliated. To crawl upon the ground and to eat the dust of the ground is not a literal sense. It's a metaphorical statement in which God says, here's what I'm going to do to you. You were at one time a beautiful being in my presence that I created, and then you fell. And I cast you out. And I cast you down to the earth. Now I'm casting you down again. I'm humiliating you a second time. I'm sending you to a place where you will no longer have power over the human creature that I have created. You will no longer be able to accomplish your purposes. Ultimately, you will be utterly humiliated. I will put enmity between you and the woman. There will be constant war between you and the woman's offspring. The human race will fight against you forever. Between your offspring and her offspring. Now notice what God says. He. Notice how he takes the pronouns from plural to singular. He. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. The great proto-evangelon. God will send a person who will come and ultimately crush the head of this creature, driving him into the ground. I find it fascinating, by the way, that he says you have been cursed above all the livestock, because I'm convinced that this creature was actually considered by God just to be another animal. Satan was treated as just another animal, and now he's going to be the worst animal. It's going to go even further down. A life of humiliation, ending, of course, in the utter destruction of this creature at the cross. We're still waiting for the day when Christ will grab this creature by the throat and cast him headlong into the lake of fire. But believe me, his doom is already sure. But then God turns to the woman, verse 16, and says, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. The pain you shall bring forth, in pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for or against your husband, and he shall rule over you. God comes to the woman, and he curses her with pain in childbearing. What was the first command that God gave to this couple? Be fruitful and multiply. And what's the curse? In the very thing you were commanded to do, you will now suffer in it. No longer will it be easy to bring forth children into the world. Now you will do so in great pain. And you will now be placed under your husband. Some commentators think that this is translated, your desire shall be to rule over your husband, to have power over him. But in fact, that power will be his. That's one way to look at that. Another possibility is that your desire, the curse, will be that you will have an insatiable desire for your husband that you will not be able to break. In fact, I think it's the latter. As I've read more and more and been married as long as I have, I'm convinced that what happens is that when a woman is joined to a man in matrimony and you give it a few years, the net result of that is a physiological change that takes place in which that woman is utterly under her husband. She cannot escape it. Why do you think so many women from battered husbands run back to them? Why do they go back? Why do they continue? Because there's something physiological going on here. It's part of the curse. Depend on your interpretation of that particular verse. It's very hard to understand what he says, but here's what I do know from all of this. God has said to the woman, to the very thing that he formed and brought to Adam as his helper to help him multiply and take dominion over the world, he curses the woman and says, the very thing that you were created to do, you will struggle to do. It will be difficult. It will be painful. There will be suffering involved in it. And all of you who are mothers will go, amen, brother. But then we come to chapter 3, 17. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Again, what was the first command given to the couple? Take dominion over this earth. God said, I give you, Adam, dominion over everything. Go and use it. Go and take it. It's yours. Rule over it. Now, it will no longer be ruled by you. You will not be able to stop the weeds from growing in your garden. No amount of Roundup will ever get rid of the weeds in your yard. You will never stop them. You will never be able to grow all the food perfectly that you need to survive. There will be famine. There will be hunger. There will be problems because of the fact that this man chose to listen to his wife. Great toil will come. Paul expands upon this curse in Romans 8 when he talks about the fact that all of creation was subjected. Remember, this was a specific action by God. Okay, don't forget this. God took this created world, which was good and perfect and right when he formed it, and what does he do? He messes it all up. He subjects the whole thing to futility. The whole thing is subjected to futility. This is not just a consequence of sin. Okay, make sure you understand this. The curse is not just a consequence of sin. It is the direct action of God to frustrate his creation and to frustrate human beings living in it. Okay? God said there will be trouble. The serpent, you will struggle against humanity, and humanity will struggle against you. The woman, you will desire to bring forth children to help your husband multiply, and you will struggle in it. You will suffer in it. And man, you will try to grow food and take care of your family, and you will work, and it won't work out. There'll be crop failures and lack of rain and a thousand other things that'll go wrong in you trying to do what you're supposed to do. Now, think about all of that in relation to the creation mandate. The judgment made by God on Adam and Eve was to frustrate their ability to keep the commands of Genesis 1:28. As I said, Eve would struggle to bring forth children. Adam would struggle to bring forth food. This curse also extends itself into marriage. The curse itself also brings into the very essence of marriage itself. Now, let me remind you again of what I said a moment ago. Marriage is the foundation upon which the creation ordinance was established, right? At the beginning, what did God do? God said, let us create man in our image, male and female. He created them. And then the first thing he said to them is, go and take dominion of this earth. I'm bringing the two of you together as male and female. I'm going to bring you together that you will take this world and you will take dominion over it and you will rule over there, everything. Eve was brought to Adam as his helper to fulfill his purpose. Together, as husband and wife, they would multiply and fill the earth. And from that, civilization would grow and humanity would take dominion over the whole earth. Now, Not only was the result of that union corrupted, but the union itself was corrupted. The form itself, which pictured not only what God was going to do in creation as a whole, was corrupted, but now the actual union between the two themselves was corrupted. There's no better picture of it than the very first words out of Adam's mouth. When God says to him, "Why are you naked? Why did you eat of the tree? What does the man say?" Chapter 3, verse 12, "The woman you gave me, she gave me the fruit and I ate." Who does he blame it on? Like all things in the created order, the institution of marriage and individual marriages themselves have been corrupted by sin from both the outside and from the inside. The corruption of marriage isn't just from the outside, it's not just from the inside, it's from both. So let me explain what I mean by that. Let's talk about the corruption of marriage from the inside. Or as someone told me this morning, let's go from preaching to meddling. What has been the primary effect of the fall upon the nature of human beings? When Adam sinned, what was the primary effect that it had upon individual human beings? What effect did it have on me? What effect did it have on you? And the answer is this. The fall gave to us a built-in and radical self-centeredness. This is what we've become. By virtue of the fall, our primary concern now is about ourselves. Me. What matters the most in this world, me. It's all about my happiness. It's all about what I can get, my pleasure, my goals, my desires, and the list goes on. Me, 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 me. And dare I suggest, by the way, and I've said this many times, I know, that much of the preaching that goes on in the church today is nothing more than me, 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 me. It's all about me, 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 and how happy I can be. In fact, I think in most churches, the best thing that they could do is take the pulpit out and just put a big mirror there. And just let all the people sit there and stare at themselves, because that's what they're doing. It's all about us. It's all about my self-focus, my self-centeredness, my selfishness, what I want. Now, let me suggest to you, that's exactly how Eve was tempted by this serpent. What did the serpent say? "You shall be like God, knowing good and evil." And notice, this is a verse you don't hear very often, but I love this verse, chapter 3, verse 6. "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and she ate." Why did she eat from the tree? Because it looked good. Because she saw something there. "Hey, I'm going to eat from that tree, and woo-hoo. This is going to be great." We are fundamentally inclined to concentrate on ourselves. Adam and Eve took their eyes off of their God, their Creator. They took their eyes off of Him and they put their eyes on the tree. And the devil, with a little nudge, just got the woman to see just how that looks. And the net result of that is that human beings locked themselves into that mode forever. We became utterly self-absorbed. The internal corruption of marriage then occurs when you try to take two utterly self-centered people and bind them together. I love weddings, I said, remember last week, because I get to watch a one flesh union appear in front of me. But at the same time, it is one of the most frustrating things imaginable. Because I'm taking two utterly self-centered creatures and molding them into one. What a pain. And for the next however many years, the goal is to try to make them one flesh as two very self-centered individuals. We are fundamentally self-centered. The two great sins of marriage, by the way, which are ensconced in the law, adultery and divorce, are fundamentally selfish in nature, are they not? Well, he's not given what I need, or she's not given what I need, but that guy is, or that woman is, so I'm going to go get that because it's about what I need and what I want. Doesn't matter what's between us, I want that. I want that. Or I don't want you. They're exactly contrary to the very purposes of God. Right? Adultery is a picture of covenantal unfaithfulness. God is covenantally faithful. Adultery is the opposite. Divorce is a picture of a broken covenant. God's in the business of keeping his covenants. Divorce is exactly the opposite of that, isn't it? So the result of that is this bit of bad news that you are ultimately familiar with. There is no perfect marriage in this fallen world. And there never will be. As long as it's made up of fallen people, as long as it's made up of those who come from Adam and Eve, there will never be perfect marriages in this world. For those of you who are single and looking for someone to marry, don't be naive. There's no such thing as a perfect marriage. But God is in the process of redeeming marriage. Okay? Now, and that's, all of that was bad news, and you're all looking like, he's got to get to the punchline eventually. Yeah, here it is. Yeah, God is in the business of redeeming marriage just like he's redeeming everything else. So how do you form a redeemed one-flesh union in this world of two people who are fundamentally self-centered? How do you do that? Well, there's one way that doesn't work, and there's one way that does. There's the modern approach. The modern approach is, well, if we just take these people together and we apply some communication techniques for them, and then we put some problem-solving techniques in front of them, and we get them to learn how to compromise with one another, then we can figure out how to make the perfect marriage. I really need one of those buzzers. I got to get me one of those. Game show buzzer, you know. No. Does that change the heart of the individual in the relationship? No. Does it change the marriage ontologically? How do you take two people who are in themselves fundamentally self-centered and turn them into a redeemed one-flesh union? And the answer to that question is in doing the same thing in that marriage that Christ does in bringing his people to himself. He takes out the heart of stone. What we need as believers, and this doesn't work out there in the world, of course, because the only thing they have is psychotherapy, but what we have as those who belong to Christ, the picture that Paul is ultimately painting in Ephesians 5, what we have is a picture of a God who is using marriage as symbolic, as a picture. You take out the heart of stone in that relationship when you turn the hearts and the eyes and the minds of each partner to Jesus Christ. It's not about trying to build the relationship between the two individuals in some sort of magic therapy session, but rather it's about taking a wife and turning her eyes upon Christ and taking a husband and turning his eyes upon Christ. And guess what? The marriage relationship will itself grow and be redeemed by the redemption of the two individuals. Fundamentally, that's what Paul is trying to say very long-windedly in 1 Corinthians 7. I challenge you, married couples, to go home and read 1 Corinthians 7. And think about the overarching message that Paul is trying to make. He's not trying to make, well, here's the certain condition that you can get out of this marriage, and this is the certain condition you ought to stay, and so forth. All of that is details. The overarching message that Paul is bringing is, if you take the hearts and minds of two fundamentally self-centered individuals and turn them to Christ, the net result of that will be that their relationship with one another will grow. The fact is, as I've experienced it, I think that the vast majority of marital problems that people have, especially amongst those who claim to be followers of Christ, is that one or both of the partners are not, in fact, fixed in faith upon Christ. That's usually where the problem comes. Because of the fallen nature of humanity and our varying levels of self-centeredness, the internal boundaries for marriage are always far short of the original standard established by God. But it can be changed in the way that God has ordained in His Word. Fix your eyes upon Jesus. But there's also a corruption of marriage from without, though. The problem isn't that we're just struggling with one another. We're also struggling with everything going on around us. Fallen human beings have been attempting to redefine the concept of marriage in accordance with their own ideas from the very beginning of time. So part of our problem is we struggle with each other as self-centered creatures, but the other is that we're being attacked from the outside. So we have problems with the corruption of marriage from without. Think about it. Eve redefined the value and nature of the tree of knowledge, did she not? She looked at it and said, hey, this thing looks good for food. I'm going to change why you ought not to eat it or why you can eat from it. So she was attacked from the outside in terms of the tree of knowledge to think of it differently. And that's exactly what's been going on in marriage for a very long time. Think about all the redefinitions of marriage that have been going on through the centuries, right? You only have to get to Genesis chapter 4 to find the first one. After Cain kills his brother and a few generations later, there's a man by the name of Lamech who brags about the fact that he killed a man and that he has multiple wives. So he starts redefining marriage, or I should say the human race starts redefining marriage, almost immediately. The 1689 Confession in chapter 25, paragraph 4, deals with the problem of incestuous relationship, incestuous marriage. In America, we invented the idea of no-fault divorce. So we redefine marriage by saying, well, it's not really about producing a one-flesh union in which both are 100% engaged with one another in the relationship, but rather we've created some sort of a social contract which allows two individuals to come together for a period of time, and then if it doesn't work out, they can just walk away and nobody's at fault. It'll be easy to separate. I'm Earl Scheib, and I'll divorce your wife for you for $59.99. Sounds stupid, but that's precisely what's happened in our culture. And of course, we have probably the worst redefinition, although I would argue that it's simply the natural result of all the previous ones, and that's the Obergefell decision of a few years ago, ensconcing this thing called gay marriage, notice the quotes, into law. All of these redefinitions of marriage strike at the heart of the creation ordinance itself. Remember? They violate the one flesh relationship in various ways. They take this, which was supposed to be a one flesh relationship, and they create multiple flesh relationships or strange flesh relationships rather than the one flesh relationship that God intended between male and female. They specifically pervert God's intention for marriage both within itself and to its global ends. The modern redefinition of marriage as between two men or two women is one example. And I'm going to do this very, very quickly. I spoke on this a number of years ago with an entire sermon, but I want to just sift this down to help you see this. You know, there's a lot of excuses that people will use today to justify this idea of two men be married or two women be married. But here's the most common one. The most common one is Jesus, you know, you Christians talk about Jesus and you rely on him. But you know, Jesus never spoke about homosexuality. I'll grant that. He never did. Therefore, now notice the conclusion. Therefore, he does not condemn it. And he would grant those, now listen to this carefully, he would grant those formed by God in that state, in a state of homosexuality, to enjoy all the blessings available to others. Now, let me assure you, the vast majority of millennials would agree with that statement today. Okay? Make no mistake about it. The idea is why should we not extend a benefit to this particular class of people when this other class of people has had it all along? See, and it's really hard to argue against that, isn't it? I mean, after all, it's an emotional argument. Why would you restrict something from this group of people? I mean, aren't we living in a society in which we should all have the rights, quote unquote? And that's exactly what Justice Kennedy did. He created a right out of whole cloth. It didn't exist, but he made it up. The response of this should be very simple. Mark chapter 10 and Matthew chapter 19, Jesus has a confrontation with the religious leaders of his day. They come to him and they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? They're trying to trip him up. He's smarter than they are. And he speaks to them about this. And he turns the question back upon them. And in doing so, he gives a broad response to the overarching principle in play. He says, have you not read? What's he talking about? Well, from your own scriptures, which you claim to be experts at. Have you not read that in the beginning, God created them male and female, and it is from that union that marriage comes. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. He appeals, you remember, to the original design of humanity by God as the basis of all human sexuality and marriage. Therefore, all other forms of sexuality or marriage are incompatible. They don't make sense within the very creation ordinance itself. You cannot have a world filled with men marrying each other who will be fruitful and multiply. Doesn't work. I know modern science gives you some help, but it doesn't work. In other words, there's a sense in this example of a pressure being applied outside of marriage itself for us to conform our understanding of marriage to the prevailing views of what marriage are, what marriage is. You are being told every time you turn on the television to watch any of the shows that are typically on in our day, you are being told there is a new way of thinking about human sexuality. There's a new way to understand humanity. And it's not that old fogey version of Christianity. We need to get rid of that. What we need is the freedom to be able to express our sexuality in whatever way that we want to. But notice what it does. That is a form of rebellion against the very creation itself. It's a form of rebellion against what God had established from the very beginning when he said, let us make man in our image, male and female, and turn them loose to take dominion over the earth. What have we been doing since then? Attempting to thwart the original plan of God in establishing his creation. And the necessary result of that is that you and I, as husbands and wives, will be attacked by those definitions outside. The outside. Because of the fallen nature of humanity, let's summarize it this way, because of the fallen nature of humanity and our desire to be like God, the external
boundaries for what constitutes marriage are constantly being pushed away from what God originally intended the institution to be. Or let me summarize it this way. As husbands and wives, we push against each other, and then society tries to push us apart as well. The necessary effect then is that we are being constantly told within ourselves and by those outside of ourselves that there's a different picture. But what is the picture? What is marriage? What are the boundaries of this thing? And the answer is what God Himself has created. So when we think about marriage, we think about it in terms of its definition, its creation and covenantal reality, and how it fits with what God formed, what value it has both to society as a whole and to us one another, and to the boundaries that God Himself has established within it, meaning male and female working together to take dominion over the earth which God had created. All of those things make up a general definition of marriage. But here's where it comes down to. Marriage is God's idea. It's God's idea. It's what He had in mind at the very foundation of the human race. It's what He had in mind. When we come together to celebrate a wedding, for example, it isn't just about watching two people come together and join their lives together. What we're watching is we're watching God say, "This is the very foundation of human existence. This is what I created," God said, at the very foundation of this thing called earth. It is also what He intended for mankind to fill His creation and subdue it in every way. We want to know why we're not being successful at subduing our creation? It's because of the curse that's been placed upon us, but it's also because we keep redefining marriage. Thirdly, it's what He established to bring fulfillment and stability to every human civilization. Make no mistake about it, part of the reason, the primary reason, not the part of the reason, the primary reason why America is struggling today is because it has abandoned marriage at the core, a biblical view of marriage at its core. Fourthly, it is what He uses. Marriage is what God uses to picture both His own triune nature and the relationship of Christ to His church. When we watch a husband and we watch a man and a woman become husband and wife, we're not just picturing two people coming together. We're watching what God Himself looks like. And we're watching what He has done to build a relationship of His people to Himself, or more specifically, to His Son. And then finally, it is what He glories in as He redeems a people for Himself and presents them as a bride to His Son. It's what He glories in. He glories in families of husbands and wives and children. He glories in that because it's a picture of His relationship with His Son and a picture of what He's intended to do in His world. So it is God's own design. It's His idea. It's what He wants to do. And as a church, as the church of Jesus Christ, we must never capitulate to our culture on this issue of marriage. This is the worldview that Paul has. This is what underscores where Paul will go in verses 5, in Ephesians 5, 22 to 33. You have to have an understanding of the fundamental nature of the human race at its core in marriage in order to understand what he's talking about here. And I've given you some hints of where we're going to be going, Lord willing, in the weeks ahead. Let's pray. I thank you, Father, that it's your idea to bring together husbands and wives. It's your idea to establish this institution and its value in this world. And I thank you that you continue to draw men and women together all over this planet, continuing to bring them together in order to produce civilization, stability, economic growth. But Father, I'm much more grateful that in the church, inside the church of Jesus Christ, you have brought together men and women, built up together,
as a picture of the bride that you are building for your son. And so, Father, here's my prayer for us who are married, or for those who are seeking to be married. I pray, Father, that you will help us as we consider our marriage relationships, that it's not about us at all, individually. It's never about us individually. It's about that new creation that you have formed between us as husbands and wives. That new creation which pictures so vividly the relationship that we have with Christ as our groom and the relationship that we have with one another as those who belong to this great institution, the church. Help us to consider these things, O Lord. Help us to pause and ask ourselves whether we're in our marriages because they're, well, making us feel good, or whether we're in our relationships with our husbands and wives for the greater good of the church and the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Use our relationships, Father. Help us to grow up with one another, to truly love one another in the way that Christ loves us, but also to give ourselves self-sacrificially as Christ did, so that the picture to the world that we present as husbands and wives is a picture of the relationship of God the Father, God the Son. Only you can do this in and through us, Father, because we're just a bunch of selfish people, self-centered. Yes, you have taken out our heart of stone, but we still struggle with the flesh. So, Father, help us to truly be what you have commanded us to be in marriage. I ask these things for you to do in Jesus' name.